back here on the Mighty 690 at 7:42. And joining us, we have Holly Miner, K-State Research and Extension Food Safety Nutrition Agent. And we also have Wendy Powell, Livestock Production Agent. Good morning, ladies.
Hello.
Good morning.
All righty. So we are going to do something a little special here this morning. So we do have Holly Miner with us, and we're going to be taking your questions, anything related to, you know, food safety, nutrition. This is going to be a great time for you to get some of those questions answered. So if you're interested in calling in and asking Holly a question, well, give her a call at 620-251-6909, and we'll get you here in line for that. So again, 620-251-6909 or 1-800-252-KGGF, and we will get your questions answered here this morning. But before we begin, of course, Holly, do you have some events coming up you want to tell us about?
I do. There's a youth sewing classes, which will start in January. They start on the 4th of January. They are on Thursdays, and they will be for 4 weeks. So they kind of progress on each other. So we'll start out on the 4th of January with those sewing classes. They can call our office at 620-331-2690 to register for those. There's a $5 charge, and they're for youth ages 8 and up. And if they have no sewing experience at all, we ask that an adult comes with them.
Okay.
And there's several spots still available. And then in February, we'll talk about this more later, but we have a radon information program that will be happening on February 6th here in Coffeyville. And so anybody that wonders whether their house has radon or how to determine that, this would be a great opportunity for them to come and learn more about radon. There is a very high prevalence of radon in Kansas, so it's something that we definitely want people to be aware of. And I had a house in Parsons that had radon in it, so I was very surprised by that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this geography, and anytime you're dealing with limestone, that can definitely be an issue, and even some other topography. So very good, Holly. And yeah, once again, if you have questions this morning for Holly, give us a call, 620-251-6909 or 1-800-252-KGGF. Anything at all related to food safety, you know, sometimes I can talk about canning, talk about crock pots. I mean, the sky's the limit here. But Holly, I know in the meantime, you do want to talk a little bit about some topic related to chocolate.
Yeah, so this is the time of year when a lot of people are eating chocolate. We eat it in different candies and things like that. We eat chocolate all year long, but it seems like Christmas time is kind of a time where we have some unusual kinds of chocolate, like fudge and some of those special Christmas candies that we have. So there's just a few things I'd like to share. Chocolate does not really have a shelf life. It does have a best use by date if you look at it, and that's the date where the chocolate has the most I don't want to say nutritional value, but the quality of the chocolate doesn't change. So after that date, the quality of the chocolate could change a little bit. It could form crystals, have some sugar crystals on it, or it could have some color changes to it. So we want to make sure that when we're storing our chocolate, that we store that in an airtight container and that it's in a dry, cool environment. And we want to store it in a dark location as well. One thing that a lot of people do, they think, well, I'll stick it in the refrigerator and that'll make it better. Well, chocolate should really not be stored in the refrigerator, because if you do that, it could absorb odors and other foods and develop a moist surface when it's brought back to room temperature, which results in a bloom. And so we didn't know that chocolate could bloom like a fruit, right? But it does bloom. And if we freeze chocolate, we want to freeze it with care. We should put it in the refrigerator first to wrap it very tightly in an airtight container, and then put it in the refrigerator, and then 24 hours later put it in the freezer. And that'll help reduce the bloom from happening. So the bloom happens when the chocolate temperature is shocked. And so when we put it in the refrigerator, if it's hot outside and we put it in the refrigerator, it shocks the temperature. And that bloom appears as a dusty or streaked gray color of the surface. And it doesn't affect whether the taste of the chocolate is better or worse. And it doesn't really affect the shelf life of the chocolate, but it does affect the aesthetic appeal of the chocolate. So there's two types of blooms that can occur, a fat bloom or a sugar bloom. And a fat bloom is the result of it being exposed to warm temperatures, which cause the cocoa butter to soften and separate. And then that leaves the streaking white gray color of the chocolate. When you run your finger across the surface, that flat fat bloom feels really smooth. Now, the sugar bloom is the result of exposure to humidity and moisture. So when the sugar particles in the chocolate absorb moisture, it causes the sugar crystals to be left on the surface of the chocolate, and it has a blotchy or a dark look, a dusty look to that chocolate. It feels rough to the surface. Sugar bloom usually occurs when it's refrigerated chocolate. So we can't reverse the bloom, but it can be remedied by melting. So by heating that chocolate back up, the fat or the sugar goes back into the chocolate, and when it's rehardened, then it has the normal color of what a chocolate would have without the bloom color on it. And so just be real careful when you're working with your chocolate that you store it in an airtight container, and you can leave it on the countertop or in the cabinet. Again, we want it to be preferably in that dark, cool place, not cold like a refrigerator, but dark, cool place and airtightly sealed.
Excellent. Well, a good reminder here is we have, you know, lots of chocolate usually around the holidays here. And want to remind you once again, if you do have a question for a food and a nutrition agent, your full title, Holly, I never remember the whole thing.
Nutrition, food safety, and health.
Okay. Well, if you have a question on any of those topics for Holly Miner, go ahead and give us a call, 620-251-6909 or 1-800-252-KGGF, as we do get into, you know, the holiday season. You know, some folks may have questions about some various holiday cooking and, you know, all these different treats that that we have here.
So I just have a couple other things I'm going to share while we're waiting for people to call, if they want to call. Fudge, when we make fudge, the moisture, the humidity in our house can also have an effect on it. So whether we get that really smooth texture of the fudge is when it has no moisture or extra humidity in the air. So fudge should be smooth and creamy, and if it gets a little grainy or crystallized, it's because the moisture in the air is attaching to the sugar and forming crystals. So that was an interesting thing I read the other day by our specialist in at the state office. And then should apple pie be refrigerated? And I would say no, apple pie doesn't need to be refrigerated. We've cooked the apples. It can sit on the counter. Most apple pies don't last more than a couple days. And so that's okay. The same with pecan pie. But if you have a custard or a cream pie, like banana cream or pumpkin, then those do need to be refrigerated because they're a custard, and that custard needs to be refrigerated.
Well, that's interesting. So, you know, speaking of the refrigerating pies, you know, at home, yeah, a lot of times we don't necessarily, you know, refrigerate those. But what about the commercial application? Are there any rules as far as maybe you have a small restaurant or that sort of thing, and maybe you have like an apple pie for your customers? Are there any like state requirements or whatnot that those need to be refrigerated, or can they set out? What's the rule?
Great question on that. And I don't know all of the state requirements. That would be something that the state health inspectors would need to talk to the restaurants about specifically. But definitely those cream pies would need to be refrigerated. So anything that we think, if you think about where a food is purchased at in the grocery store, and maybe some of those pumpkin pies are not in the refrigerated section of the grocery store, they should be. So, you know, think about that when you're thinking about whether a food can be left out or not. Cheese is always refrigerated, so anything like that at the holiday season. Dips should always be refrigerated. I don't know. What are some other things that we leave out? Hot chocolate doesn't necessarily need to be, but once we've mixed that, if it's a dry mix and we mix it up with milk, then it definitely would need to be refrigerated afterwards. Any kind of fruit juice that we open, And, you know, it's not stored in the, it's sealed up when we purchase it, so it's stored on a regular shelf without refrigeration. But once we open it, it needs to be refrigerated. So sometimes the things that we find, like salad dressings and those things, are not really refrigerated on the shelf. But once we open them, you know, our pickles or any kind of our condiment type things, those all need to be refrigerated after they're opened. And usually that'll say on the jar whether they need to be or not, if there's a question. And if you're in doubt, then put it in the refrigerator and you don't have to worry about it.
There you go.
What about our, like, charcuterie board style, like those meats? And how long should those sit on the counter to be grazed on?
So no more than 2 hours. So if you are, and I've seen a lot of posts on Facebook lately about charcuterie boards. So if you are preparing a charcuterie board for the holidays and you spend a lot of time decorating and arranging those meats, the best thing to do would be to put it on a tray, and then that tray, you can arrange it the night before. You can put that tray back in the refrigerator and then pull it out the day that you're going to, right before you're going to serve it. Any kind of perishable food like meats and cheeses should not be left out more than 2 hours. And we think about that with our holiday meals as well. Once we prepare that food and we set it out for people to eat, people go through the line, take their food, whatever. If you serve family style, you're serving your food. Say you start that at noon, you put the food out at about 11:45, and by the time you get everything out on the table, you sit down at noon and you eat. By 1:30, 2 o'clock, that food should be put back in the refrigerator. And people think, well, gosh, that's not enough time to leave it out. Well, you have to think about bacterial growth, and bacteria grows or doubles about every 15 to 20 minutes. So if you have one bacteria at the beginning, and of 2 hours, you know, that doubles every 15, 20 minutes. So you think about that there's a lot of bacteria that can grow on that. And bacteria growth happens the best, or it's the most rampant, when temperatures are between 70 degrees and 120 degrees. So if you have a cold food, keeping that food cold, like maybe putting it in a bed of ice, like if you have a dip, make another bowl that's a little bit bigger, put ice in that bowl, and then put your dip in that bowl with the ice. that will help keep that food colder. Or if you have a hot food, that serve it at temperatures well over 130 degrees, and then try to maintain that 130 degree temperature while you're serving your food. And if you do that, then you can leave foods out a little bit longer. But those charcuterie boards are usually served at room temperature, or they come out of the refrigerator and they're served and left there without any ice or anything like that. So they need to be served for 2 hours, and then they need to be put away. Anything past 2 hours, and then, you know, you could leave food out for 4 hours, but at the end of 4 hours, everything needs to be thrown away if you leave it out at room temperature over 4 hours. So, you know, to try to reduce food waste, and food's expensive, so we don't want to waste a lot of it. Just leave it out for 2 hours, put it away, get it back under refrigeration, or heat it back up. And whenever we have leftovers, we always want to make sure we're heating those leftovers to 165 degrees.
That's a great reminder. We can still squeeze one call in if you're interested in chatting with Holly Miner, asking her a question at 620-251-6909. And Holly, a question that I have is, you know, we're thinking about maybe trying some fondue this Christmas, something a little different. So any particular tips on any of that when it comes to fondue?
Yeah, so I would recommend that each time that you dip into the fondue, you have a new skewer or whatever, so that if somebody touches that with their mouth, the skewer, then they're using a clean one. Or just making sure that people know that they don't double dip to prevent bacteria from getting into the other food. But that's a fun way to do things. And if you're with family, maybe that double dipping doesn't count as much as when you're with other people. So depending on who's with you when you're doing your fondue, it may be fun, and you could give each other a hard time if they double dip. But if it's somebody that you really don't know, then you probably really don't want to double dip after them, or, you know, eat after they've double dipped. So just different things to think about. Just be courteous and making sure that you have a way for people to get the food out. And then if something falls in there and it can't get out, then maybe it just stays there till the end, you know.
Yeah, so. It's not going to probably cause any too much of an issue there. Just leave it in there.
So. Yeah.
Kind of an interesting one. So yeah, we'll see where it goes. Well, Holly, if people do, you know, maybe they're a little too shy to call in this morning, but if they do have maybe questions they want to email to you or call you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
They can call me at my office number at 620-331-2690, or they can email me at haminer at ksu.edu.
All right. Well, Holly, always a pleasure having you in the studio, and I know you're a great resource this time of year with all that holiday cooking. And coming up, we are going to have Wendy Powell talking some livestock fencing. That's on the way after the news here on KGGF. 44 degrees right now in Coffeyville. Back here at 810 on the mighty 690, we have joining us Holly Miner and livestock production agent Wendy Powell. Good morning, ladies, once again.
Good morning.
Hey, so, you know, Wendy, I know we've been, you know, you've been talking some holiday, you know, topics, that sort of thing related to food and all that good stuff. But I know you want to get us talking about a topic that, you know, maybe it's not as seasonal, but we also don't want our animals getting out of the fence in the middle of Christmas dinner.
That's right. Exactly. We don't want to get that phone call. I'm very familiar with that. You've got cattle out. And you're so thankful when it's actually the neighbor's cows.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway.
Well, or people call open line and say that there's a loose cow because, you know, that happens every so often.
Yeah, they really get the word out to the radio station.
Yeah, they do.
That's a good idea. The other thing with this is folks have time off at Christmas.
That's right.
And with New Year. So fencing is one of the things that's always on the farm to-do list. And so I thought maybe we would just chat about some of the reasons we have a fence and some of the ways that we can maybe pinch a few pennies or make things a little bit more efficient. So the main reasons we even put up a fence is naturally to contain our animals. Kansas is a fence-in state, so livestock owners, all animal owners, are required to contain their own animals.
So you're saying there's some states that they don't have that law?
That's correct.
So
some states are fence out states.
Okay.
So like if you want to protect your lawn or something from someone's roaming animals, then your property needs to be fenced by you and not, it's not necessarily excluded.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. So but Kansas is a fence in state.
I'm sure there's still rules regarding like highways and that sort of thing though everywhere because we don't want animals wandering onto the highway.
So since you've already mentioned that, in Kansas, we do have, so it's a fence-in state. We're required to keep our animals in. And if animals do get out and there's damage on a road or a highway, then yes, the livestock animal owner could be held responsible if neglect of the fence is proven. So like if the livestock owner knows there's a hole in the fence and hasn't taken care of the problem, then they can be held liable.
Gotcha.
However, if overnight a tree falls on a fence and then animals get out and damage happens, a car accident or whatever, then the livestock owner is not responsible.
Sure.
So, but we're still a fence-in state, so it's still important to contain your animals. The other reason we might put up a fence is for herd protection, so to prohibit predators, especially with small ruminants. This is something that we do. Electric fencing really does deter a lot of coyotes or roving dogs, anything like that. So herd protection is another one. And then protecting lands, like I had mentioned a minute ago, exclusions. If you've got certain areas that you don't want grazed or you don't want any animals on, then you might exclude it. So you would put a fence around it to be excluded from any livestock. So whenever you're thinking about maybe a new fence, things to be considerate of, boundaries, regulations, zoning ordinances, these are the things, the legal side of things, maybe not so fun, but definitely can be more unfun if you do it wrong. Because fencing is costly, it's a lot of labor, and you certainly don't want to get going on a big project and then find out that you're in the wrong spot. So don't do that. The other thing, whenever you're building new fence or maybe just reconstructing something, neighbor communication. This is one of the biggest neighborly complaints, fencing, that you can have. So just communicate with your neighbor. If there's a tree, you know, that's on one side of the fence, but there's a limb hanging over the other side and you need to do some fixing of that, just talk to your neighbor. You know, if it's the neighbor's tree, but it's a problem on your place, you know, they might not have a problem with you doing a little bit of trimming, or maybe they want that entire tree out of there also. So just communicate with your neighbor, and navigate that conversation considerately. So physical fences, there's two types of fences, physical and psychological is how one of the fact sheets that I looked at broke them down. Physical fences are actual permanent fences that you can see, feel. Long-term, usually you find these on the perimeter of properties. They're typically low maintenance, but they do have a lot of installation labor. They're usually not very... you can't really relocate them. So if you are driving down the highway and you look at a cattle fence, that's, you know, barbed wire and T-posts, it's pretty difficult to relocate those things. Repairs on those, like a tree falling on the fence, can be time consuming because there's several wires that in a row that are damaged, and you might have to redo some of that and maybe replace a few T-posts. If they're properly built, these costly fences can return their value in a very short time. So rather than trying to do electric fencing on a perimeter, that can be really costly as well, but then also time consuming in repairs. Psychological fencing, I've spoke earlier this year about virtual fencing, which is kind of a new thing in the livestock world. It's similar to what a dog collar would be with virtual fencing for dogs. Just think on a grander scale. And then electric fencing. So yes, there is a physical wire with electric fencing, but it's not the wire itself that stops the animal. It's the training that animal has received by use of that electric fence. So electric fences, they're typically portable, lightweight, very easy to set up, more inexpensive than a big barbed wire fence, and they do deter predators a lot more than a barbed wire fence would. However, they are not as durable as a permanent fence. And when an electric fence goes down, or if one part of the fence is grounded out or a tree falls on that, then your whole entire fencing off of that charger is down. So if one section is down, it's all down. And that makes it frustrating because, like with a more physical fence, a barbed wire situation, then like I've mentioned that tree before, then it's only that one section where the tree has damaged the fence. So animals can learn that those electric fences have, that's creating a boundary, so it offers a benign shock to anything that gets close to it, and then the animal knows. And whenever you move that animal from one pasture or another situation, then that same material being used tells that animal that, hey, I'm not supposed to go that far, that's not my space. So animals do learn, cattle, small ruminants for sure, and those are great options for interior fencing, rotational grazing, those situations. If you're looking at building a fence or remodeling something, the options in materials are so vast. You've got your twisted wire, barbless. You can do mesh fencing, and there's all kinds of designs and shapes and sizes, tensile strength of the wires, the material, aluminum, carbon, poly. It's really mind-boggling the different materials you might have to look through.
Well, and even those old limestone post rocks, you know, yes, sort of things that back in the day, there's still some people who like that look and they keep doing it.
Yes, and you know, the big, it's a round, like, hog wire fencing that they just pile rocks inside for corner posts. Mm-hmm. It's an older style, but we still see some of it around here. Yeah, there's posts, homemade posts, just trimmed limbs or whatever, treated wood, fence stays, T-posts of all kinds of quality and size, pipe of all kinds of size and quality. So whenever you're building a fence, just expect to spend some time price shopping and build the fence to what your purpose is. So, I mean, if you're trying to fence in some buffalo, you certainly need to have a really high, tight, strong wire. But if you're working on hogs, hogs don't really jump, so you don't have to worry so much about going high as strong and low to the ground. So those are some of the differences. We're going to talk about some species differences here in a minute. But you might visit with a fence consultant. Some of those dealers, yes, they are pushing their own product, but they also know a lot about the different products. So just having a conversation and making sure you spend the time to really do your research. Just expect to spend some time and some dollars on new fencing.
Sure, and I know that, you know, back in the day, there was like a million different types of barbed wire. There are barbed wire museums. I mean, people get really into it, but pretty much today, there's one main type of barbed wire that at least I see around. There may be a few others, but there's kind of one standard that we seem to have settled on.
Yeah, there one style, I would say, but there's still some variance with, is the barb wrapped around both twisted wires, or is it around one of the wire, and then there's a barbless wire that's twisted with it. So then the barbs actually stay in their assigned spot rather than sliding along. I know, it's mind-boggling, and then the tensile strength of those different twisted wires, and sometimes you'll see like a gray barbed wire, or the twisted wire is gray and the barbs are red, so it's a bit more visible. So there's so many variants.
It's wild. Yeah.
Yes. So just expect to spend some time on research for your project. We'll talk about some small ruminants here. So sheep and goats, they are lightweight and low to the ground. So if you're doing fencing for them, you want to use small openings so they can't put their head through and get stuck, especially goats with their horns. And electric fencing, use a really strong charger. There's a lot of net fencing out there that's kind of come on the market that's very effective. So it's kind of like a hog wire 4x4 squares that you would roll out. And you can move it around. It's sometimes a poly material. Like I said, small ruminants are lower, closer to the ground, so sometimes they're not as well grounded as like a cow would be because they're just not as heavy. So that's why that charger needs to be good and strong. Their wool on sheep is insulating.
Yeah.
So, and we can even talk about that with the winter coats on cattle and other animals. You know, when there's more protection there from the animal between the charge and the animal, then it's not going to be as effective. That shock that's offered is not always going to reach its destination. So a lot of times in sheep and goat operations, there's a combination of fencing used, electric and barbed wire. And a lot of times you'll see like panels overlaid existing barbed wire fences. So you don't have to completely take out a fence to put in some sheep and goat friendly situations. Typically, our area has cattle fencing. We just, when drive down the highway, a lot of folks will see this. It's barbed wire and T-posts. Most of the time, it's 5 wires. 4 is also common. Sometimes you'll see 6. It just depends on how secure and how much money that fencer had to put into that project. So perimeters always need to be permanent fencing, and then interior fences for rotational grazing or separating different groups can be the temporary or electric fences. Electric fences for cattle can have fewer wires than with sheep and goats, and they can be higher off the ground compared to sheep and goats, but cattle, obviously they're a larger animal, so they travel a little bit more. They know they can learn that fence training. However, keep in mind whenever you're putting bulls out that bulls on electric fence, breeding bulls are really ambitious. We'll just put it that way. They're really ambitious. And so if they have a neighboring cow herd that looks enticing, then that fence will be challenged. Horses. So horses are really fast-moving and excitable animals. We all know that, those graceful creatures. So we want to make for sure that we are using fencing that is not going to damage them if they get excited about something and then they don't see the fence. So barbless wire for horses. If you use electric fencing for horses, horses are sensitive to shock. Then you want to use what would they call tape. It looks like, you know, a line of scotch tape. It's a little bit more durable than scotch tape, but it's more visible. Usually it's white. And so the animal would see that a little bit better than the typical small electric wire. So horses are easily excitable, so they can become entangled and injured quickly. And that's certainly not something that we want to do. So use electric fencing on horses sparingly.
Gotcha.
And then I had a wild hair and I looked up some fencing for alpacas.
Hey, I know people with alpacas.
Yeah. So fencing for alpacas is focused more on keeping predators out than animals in. So it's kind of the opposite of what we think of with cattle or sheep and goats. So you want a 5-foot-tall, very sturdy fence, what they call non-climb, which non-climb simply means that humans or animals can't really get a foothold on it. So they're not climbing the fence. So obviously non-climb is a very self-explanatory term. So on the outside of perimeter fencing, you want to use 2 electric wires along the perimeter, 6 inches and 24 inches above the ground. And that really prevents predators from digging or climbing, because that's the function of an alpaca fence, is to keep predators out. Cattle fencing is discouraged with alpaca fencing. So if you have a cattle operation and you're considering going into alpaca ranching, then you want to definitely redo your fence, because alpacas have such long necks. They can go stick their head out in one little section and then they can loop back around in another section and then they're stuck. So that was something that I learned this week. But with any and all fences and any and all species, you want to check your fence regularly for security and make for sure that it's doing a good job.
Well, and of course, with the cattle fencing, you want to make sure they can stick their heads through so they can eat the grass on the other side. That's you know, why else are you a cow if you can't do that?
Right.
They always like to do that. Now, you didn't mention, are you familiar with the moats in Holland?
Well, I mean, I know what a moat is around a castle.
Yeah. No, apparently in Holland, they train their cows, they do moats around their fields,
oh.
And then they train the cows not to cross the moat. You're not supposed to cross the moat, and they don't, I guess, which is
interesting.
Weird. But yeah, they do a whole thing where they, I mean, like, we don't have time for that, but they do. That's one of those things that they do. So,
well,
and then there's no barbed wire marks or anything on them, and that's then the Italians buy the leather, and that's great leather because it's not all marked up.
Oh, fancy. So. Yes. Well, animals can learn. We know that with electric fencing, so why not with moats?
If you're really ambitious, do a moat.
There you go.
Maybe not in the dry
Kansas
weather.
Yeah, if you're in Southeast Kansas and we've got some drought going on, maybe not, but that's pretty wild.
Absolutely. Anytime anybody wants to chat about fencing options or navigate that situation, give me a holler. I can be reached at the Altamont office, 620-784-5337.
Okay, great reminder there, Wendy. We'll appreciate you coming on by and letting us know. Did you have any events that are coming up to tell us about?
Well, we have some great events coming up in February and March. So in early February, we're doing a QuickBooks training. So anybody that's wanting to revamp their record-keeping system, that'll be February 3rd in Parsons. More information coming on that. February 9th, we're doing a cattle conference here in Coffeyville. That'll be a big trade show situation, as well as, spoiler alert, possibly a BQA training, which is Beef Quality Assurance. So that will be a really great event. More information coming soon.
Hey, that's great. And Holly, do you want to run through real quick your upcoming events?
Sure. So the youth sewing classes that will be held in Independence starting January 4th. Registration is due by this Friday, so that's in a couple days. And the radon class that's going to be in February coming up. We also have youth quilting classes starting in February on those Thursdays too. So if you go to the sewing class, just continue on through the quilting class and we'll get you taken care of with that. The Ag Agents and I are also teaming up to do a workshop series on homesteading topics, which is new. And so Wendy and I and James and Jesse and Nadavin will all be working on a program coming up. There'll be 10 sessions in that series, and we're going to start that in March. So look for more information to come on that. We're really excited about being able to team up and offer those classes.
That's super fun and kind of trendy these days.
Lots of good topics. We had quite a few meetings to discuss topics, and
it's hard to pare it down.
Yeah, we think this is something that will, if people are interested in, we'll continue this on from year to year. So topics will change, but the series will stay the same. So fun stuff.
All right, I like that idea. Okay, well, Holly Miner. And Wendy Powell, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
And hope you have a great Merry Christmas coming up. So look forward to talking to you here in the new year, I guess.
You too.
You as well, James.
All righty. Take care. Hey, we do have Open Line coming up here on the Mighty 690.